I'm set. I'll talk about anions in spin models and fractional quantum Hall systems, mostly about the spin models. These are the topics I'm going to discuss. I'll start with the motivation. My motivation was quantum computing. And anions, at least in theory, provide a nice way to do fault-tolerant quantum computation. Also, I'll talk about abelian anions. In the toric code model, this is a pedagogical model built of spins, and it is exactly solvable and actually very easy to solve. And there are some related models in the same universality class that are not so easy to solve, but they may be more realistic. Then I'll discuss non-abelian anions in a Honeycomb lattice model. It's a special, exactly solved model. And also non-abelian anions in the Moore-Reed state or the Pfeiffen state, which are very similar, and also the observation of anions, detection of anions. To me, the most exciting thing about anions is that they could help quantum computation. We know that quantum computers are cool because they will allow us to do wonderful things. The most important one is simulation of quantum systems. That may not sound exciting for people on the street, but for us physicists, it's very important. The other thing which may be more exciting to some people, but probably not so good. It's factoring large integers. This can be used to crack crypto systems commonly in use. On a quantum computer, there is an exponential speed up for the solution of this problem. There is a couple of problems with quantum computation there. First, there is no scalable technology to build a quantum computer. And I would say that we're still at the same stage, or maybe a little bit more advanced than Charles Babbage was with a classical computer. He did have tools to build some simple computers, mechanical computers, and even before him, mechanical computers were built. But that was not scalable. Only new advances in technology can help in this case, and it may take time. For the classical computer, it took about 100 years. Hopefully, it will be faster with a quantum computer. But there is also an apparently fundamental problem, errors. There are two kinds of errors in a quantum computer. There are systematic errors. If we want to implement a gate U, we actually implement a gate U tilde, which is close to U, but not quite. There is some error delta. These are systematic errors, and there are also random errors, that is decoherence. It occurs due to the interaction with the environment. Both kinds of errors are bad and can destroy quantum computation. There is a general theoretical solution to the error problem. It is to introduce redundancy in the storage of quantum information. And this solution is very simple in the classical case, where we can use a very simple form of redundancy. We just repeat the same value several times, like we repeat one bit three times in this case. And this is called the repetition code. It's the simplest classical error-correcting code. In the quantum world, this solution does not work. A quantum solution has to be more tricky. Let me explain why. A characteristic feature of an error-correcting code is that two code words that are distinguishable must remain distinguishable after the error has occurred. And by distinguishable, in the quantum case, I mean orthogonal. Let's take these two code words. 0, 0, 0 is the encoding of the logical 0, and 1, 1, 1 is the encoding of the logical 1. And suppose this state remains intact, but that state undergoes an error. This is a very funny type of error. It's a phase error. It's a multiplication of the vector by a minus 1 depending on the value of the first qubit. If the first qubit is 1, then we get a minus sign. In this case, we can still distinguish the two states. So far, so good. But if we take superpositions of basic states, like the positive and negative superpositions, these are two orthogonal vectors, and they're supposed to be distinguishable after the error. But in fact, if no error occurs to the first state, it remains the same. And if the sigma z error, the phase error, occurs to the second state, it changes the minus sign to a plus sign, and we can no longer distinguish the two states. So phase errors, even if they occur in a single qubit, destroy quantum coherence for the repetition code. Of course, there is a solution, but it's more complicated. The simplest quantum error correcting code encodes one logical qubit into 5 physical qubits. And quantum gates can be implemented in such a way that the information is never decoded. It's never exposed. We operate on the logical state when it is encoded into physical qubits in some complicated way. If we ever decode this information, it becomes exposed and may be lost. In this way, we can tolerate a constant but a sufficiently small error rate. And the errors must be constantly corrected. And they must be corrected faster than they occur. Here are some general results about quantum fault tolerance. There is a so-called threshold theorem. Fault tolerant computation is possible if the physical error rate is below a certain threshold, which is in this range. The exact value is not known. And there are certain requirements on the error correcting procedure. The most restricting requirement is this: to keep decoherence in check, we must perform error correction on all the qubits in parallel. It's very important. If we leave some qubits uncorrected, the information will be lost forever. And also, there are some numerical factors. The overhead of error correction is rather large. A sufficient level of protection will likely require dozens of physical qubits per logical qubit and hundreds of physical gates per logical gate. These are just estimates, but the overhead factor is large. And most interesting algorithms do need a full-scale error correction. There is no way to get around that if we really want to use a quantum computer as a tool but not as a toy. So it's a bit pessimistic, but on the other hand, if we think about classical computing, error correction is not used, but not very often. Usually what people use is so-called codes with low check density codes, which means that there are only few errors and they can be corrected relatively easily. And in some cases, there is no error correction at all. That's because there is some built-in error correction at the physical level. If we think about how information is stored on the hard drive, it's stored in a magnetic material. The material consists of atoms that have spins. And basically, an array of spins can be stabilized by the Ising Hamiltonian. This is the Ising Hamiltonian. The coupling J makes it energetically favorable that all the spins are aligned. All the spins are pointing up or down. And if one spin is not aligned, the other spin will force it to flip back. And this is just a physical realization of the repetition code. As we know, the repetition code does not work in the quantum world, so we must think about a more complicated way to achieve stability in the physical world. And this can be done through topology. First, let me discuss classical topological defects that occur in systems like liquid crystals. In a liquid crystal or in a superconductor, there is a local order parameter. In a liquid crystal, in emetic, the local order parameter is the spatial orientation of molecules, and it can be seen in different colors when liquid crystal film is put between cross polarizers. And there are certain features in this picture that may be called vortices. This is a visualization of a vortex, not in a liquid crystal, but say in a superconductor. The direction of those little dashes shows the order parameter. The order parameter changes as we go around the vortex. And such topological defects are stable. There are conservation laws. A vortex and an anti-vortex can annihilate, but a single vortex cannot go away. Now, starting from classical vortices, we can get some intuition about quantum vortices that are called anions. An anion intuitively is a topological defect where there is no order parameter. The order parameter is destroyed by quantum fluctuations. Like in this picture, suppose we start with this configuration where we have a S1 order parameter and then shake the system so that all those dashes are pointing in different directions. But there is still a defect here. The defect is still present. The order parameter has disappeared like the Cheshire Cat smile. This doesn't actually work for S1 vortices, but it does work for Z2 vortices. And let me show a concrete Hamiltonian for Z2 vortices. This is called a toric code model. It's called so because it was first proposed as a model of a quantum error correcting code, and for that purpose it must be put on a torus. But for us, it's perfectly fine to consider it on the plane. So we have a square lattice on the plane, and there are spins on the edges of that lattice, one spin per edge. And we want to construct a quantum state that is similar to the state shown in the last picture. On each edge, we'll have a Z2 order parameter, or Z2 variable that takes values plus 1 and minus 1. And the vorticity at plaquette P is defined like the product of the spins around the plaquette. So we want the ground state to contain no vortices, but not to be restricted otherwise. So the grand state will be the uniform superposition of all states S, such that S doesn't have any vortex. S is given by the set of variables S1, S2, through Sn, where each variable refers to a particular edge in this lattice. And we're taking the quantum superposition of all vortex-free states. This is the ground state of a certain Hamiltonian. And the Hamiltonian is written here. And it includes two types of interaction. One interaction is around plaquettes. It's better to start with this one first. And this term is the product of sigma z around the plaquette boundary. Sigma z is the operator correspondent of the classical value of the variable. And it enforces the condition that there are no vortices. And this term, AV, is the product of sigma x around a vertex V. We consider the star of the vertex V, which consists of these four edges. And the operator A sub V flips the spins on the four edges. And those spin flips allow mixing of different vortex-free states, so that the ground state is actually this superposition. It's the superposition with equal coefficients due to the very strong quantum tunneling between those states. Now, let's discuss excitations in the toric code. The ground state is characterized by the condition that AV applied to the ground state gives the same state. So the ground state is invariant with respect to AV and also with respect to BP. But at some places, instead of this equation with a plus sign, we can get a similar equation with a minus sign. Such a state will have high energy. This minus sign has an energy cost. And this will be excitations. We have two types of excitations. One type of excitations live on vertices, and the other live on plaquettes. And these are called electric charges, and those are magnetic vortices. The plaquette excitations are magnetic vortices. And those charges and vortices may be regarded as just gauge particles for a Z2 gauge field. And in fact, those particles are anions, but they're mutual anions. Each of them by itself is a boson, so that if we exchange two particles, nothing happens. We know that there is another kind of statistics. When we exchange two particles, the quantum state is multiplied by a minus sign, but in both cases, if we move one particle around the other, nothing changes. In the case of toric code excitations, if we move a magnetic vortex around an electric charge, we get a minus one. So the two types of particles have non-trivial mutual statistics. And such particles are called anions. This topological effect is only possible in two dimensions. So what are abelian anions? These particles are actually abelian anions. The statistics of abelian anions is described by phase factors. And in more abstract terms, it's a representation of the Braid group, but this representation is one-dimensional. One-dimensional means that there is only one vector, and it's acted upon by multiplying by a phase. And in this picture, this is one view of a process where one particle goes around the other. And one can also use a side view where time goes up. And in this case, the same process is represented as a braid. And such anions with non-trivial branding statistics exist in fractional quantum Hall systems beyond any doubt. There have been some experimental observations of the quantum statistics that are a bit controversial, but the theory is very rigid that it's extremely unlikely that something is wrong, because there are some there are many pieces of indirect evidence that there's anions exist, like the fractional charge, which has been measured in several experiments, and this observation is very reliable. The observation of the statistics itself has not been reliable so far, but we hope this will be fixed in the near future. It turns out that the non-trivial statistics implies that the same system on the torus is degenerate, the ground state is degenerate. And the argument is very nice. It goes back to N. Arson, who applied that argument to quantum Hall systems, to the Laughlin state. If we have two particles with non-trivial statistics, we can put them on a torus, and we can imagine the following process. We create a pair of a particle and an antiparticle. The antiparticles will stay at their old places, but the particles will move. And we move those particles in a certain way. We first move the X particle, this green particle, we move it up. Then we move the Z particle to the right. Then we move the X particle back, and we move the Z particle back. So the particles go around the torus, because moving a particle from here to there means returning it to the same place. It goes around the torus. But since it moves back, effectively it doesn't move around the torus. The particles do something like this. One particle goes up. The other particle goes right. This particle goes down, and that particle goes left. And see what happened. My hands were like. Let me repeat the same thing. Up. This way, that way. My hand ended up twisted. So. It's an implementation of a braid in space-time. And we know that the effect of this action is the phase factor of minus one. Therefore, X and Z do not commute. And since two operators do not commute, they cannot act in one-dimensional space. This the representation must be at least two-dimensional. Yeah, in this case, there are two pairs of such operators, and the smallest representation turns out to be four-dimensional. So for this particular kind of anions, the ground state on the torus is fourfold degenerate. One may question this degeneracy in the physical world, because in the physical world, nothing is perfect. There are always some errors. So what happens if the Hamiltonian is not exact, but if there are some perturbations? The exact Hamiltonian has a special feature that the particles, this P particle and V particle, don't move. If we put them at some places, those states will be will be eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. In other words, the energy of the particles does not depend on their momenta. If we add perturbations, there will be some dispersion curve. The energy will depend on the momentum, and the particles will move. Since the particles move, and since the Hamiltonian may allow spontaneous creation of particle pairs. There'll be a virtual process in which two particles are created. One goes around the torus and annihilates back with its partner. So there is a virtual process where effectively one particle goes around the torus. And as we know, such a process is equivalent to the action of an operator like X or Z. So there'll be some action of those topological operators on the ground space. The ground space is four-dimensional in our case. However, all tunneling processes are exponentially suppressed in the system length. So this perturbation to the ground space is exponentially small, where L is the torus size and xi is some correlation length, which is of the order of the lattice spacing. And if we apply strong perturbations, we can construct models with completely different Hamiltonians, but still in the same universality class. In fact, the two anions with the same properties, with the same topological properties I described, were first discovered in the RVB context, resonating valence bond. And this was done by Reed and Chakraborty in 1989. And I want to emphasize that this is a very nice paper. It's really cited now. This was done a long time ago. Although there was no actual model for those anions, the models that were speculated to describe this RVB state turned out to be not so good. They didn't have the right properties. And a correct model for the state that was implicitly described in that paper was proposed by Messner and Sondi in year 2000. This is the dimer model on the triangular lattice. And it turns out that the dimer model on the cognomial lattice is exactly equivalent to the toric code. Here is the cognomial lattice. And the dimer model is not really a spin model. The elementary variables are dimers. And the condition is such that each vertex belongs to only one dimer. And those dimers can flip in a quantum way. For instance, these three dimers can rotate, and there are other moves that are allowed. Flipping of the dimers is equivalent to flipping of spins in the toric code model. But let me show you why this model is equivalent to the toric code model in a certain sense. We can construct a lattice whose vertices will be the hexagons of the cognomial lattice. It's shown in red. And for each edge of this new lattice, this thick edge, this vertex in the middle of that edge belongs to exactly one dimer. And this dimer, this fat blue edge, can be on the right or on the left. Now, if we look at a triangle, there must be exactly one dimer inside this triangle. Not zero, not two, exactly one. Because, well, actually, I'm sorry. Actually, it's possible that there are zero dimers. But it turns out that if we introduce this kind of variable, we say that the variable is zero if the dimer is on one side of the edge, and the variable is one if it's on the other side of the edge. By introducing such a variable, it turns out to be possible to map this model to the toric code model on that triangle lattice. Okay. There is yet another model, and the Hamiltonian is remarkably simple. The catch is that the model is not exactly solvable. It's spins on the vertices of a square lattice with this Hamiltonian. There are two types of interaction. On horizontal lengths, the interaction is of type sigma x, sigma x. And on vertical lengths, the interaction is of type sigma z, sigma z. And there is some numerical evidence that the ground state of this model is in the same universality class as the toric code. Finally, let me describe yet another model. It's more complicated, but it is exactly solvable. The model is formulated on a honeycomb lattice, and there are three directions of links. There are vertical links that are labeled by z, these links that are labeled by 1, and those links that are labeled by x. And the Hamiltonian is the sum of interactions along all the links, but we use different types of interactions. For x links, we use sigma x interaction with a coupling constant jx, and so on. For each link type, we have the corresponding interaction. And as we vary the parameters jx, jy, and jz, let's take a cross section of this three-dimensional phase diagram. The cross section looks like this. There is a triangle. At the corners of that triangle, one of the coupling constants is 1, the other two are zeros. And around the corners, there are gapped faces. There are three gapped faces that are all in the same universality class as the toric code. And in the middle, there is some gapless phase. When the, a phase is gapless, we cannot say that it carries anions or particle with any definite statistics. In fact, in gapless phases, statistics is not well defined, because as we move one particle around the other, other particles may be generated. And the exact effect of this process depends on how exactly we move the particles. Nevertheless, if we apply a magnetic field to this gapless phase, a gap opens, and now the statistics is defined. And the new phase carries non-abelian anions. Non-abelian anions are much more interesting than abelian ones. A system of several non-abelian anions has hidden degrees of freedom, like an abelian topological system on the torus. But here we don't need a torus. It's just a system on the plane, and which has several particles, and there are some hidden degrees of freedom that are not accessible by just acting on the spins locally. It can be accessed by moving the particles around, by braiding them, but not by playing with individual spins. And the relevant algebraic structure describing non-abelian anions was first discovered in controlled field theory by Moore and Seiberg, and in quantum Chern-Simons theory by Witten. But mathematically, it's something called unitary modular tensor category. Although it has the word category in it, which is rather scary, it can be formulated as a set of algebraic data and equations, so everything is finite and can be manipulated with on a piece of paper or on a computer. There is a certain set of equations that need to be satisfied. And there are some physical examples. The Pfeiffian state or Moore-Ridge state that is believed to exist in fractional quantum Hall systems at this filling factor, and parafermionic state. Both states were mentioned by Chetan Nayak this morning. So let me focus on the anions in the honeycomb lattice model, and the anions in the 5N state are actually very similar. The anions in the honeycomb lattice model can be of three types. One means no particle, and there are epsilon particles, which are fermions, and there are special sigma particles, which are non-abelian anions. These are the fusion rules. If we fuse two sigma particles, you see that the outcome may be one, the particles may annihilate completely, or the outcome may be epsilon. So if we just have two sigma particles, one here and the other there, we don't know what the outcome will be. In a way, nature knows the answer, but the answer is well hidden. We cannot know the answer until we actually fuse the particles. So there are actually two states, one corresponding to the fusion outcome 1 and the other corresponding to the fusion outcome epsilon. And those states have exactly the same energies and other physical characteristics. We cannot distinguish these two states. Well, of course, again, nothing is perfect, and there is a process that may distinguish these two states. It's a tunneling of a virtual epsilon particle. Since this fusion rule is present, an epsilon particle can be emitted or absorbed by a sigma particle. And if we have two stationary sigma particles that just stay at given places, epsilon particles may tunnel. But in reality, this will occur with an exponentially small rate. The rate of tunneling is exponentially small in the distance between the sigma particles. So this is a very good protection offered by nature. The difference between those states is protected from us as well as from the decoherence-causing environment. However, there is a problem in using just those two states to implement a qubit, an element of a quantum computer. And the problem is that the states belong to different superselection sectors. Okay. And there is a solution to this problem by using four anions. The first pair of anions can be in state 1 or epsilon, and the second pair of anions can be in state 1 or epsilon. But we can create a logical zero where both pairs are in state 1, and logical 1 where both states are in state epsilon. And these logical states can form quantum superpositions. In particular, if we create the two pairs in these two different ways, this will correspond to certain quantum superpositions. And the relation between these two states and those two states is given by so-called associativity relations, which correspond to splitting one sigma particle into three sigma particle into four different ways. And there are certain algebraic relations between apparatus that affect the splitting. Another piece of algebraic structure is related to braiding. These are the braiding rules for the sigma particles. And the braiding depends on whether they fuse into 1 or into epsilon. And putting all those rules together, we get this table. It contains all algebraic properties of those particles. And the same algebraic structure is found in the conformal field theory corresponding to the Eisen model at the critical point. However, the Eisen model has actually more structure, whereas here we just have pure algebra, no analytic functions. It's actually simpler. And finally, I want to emphasize three properties of anions that can be used to detect them in an experiment. The first property is most important. It's not that fancy property like non-trivial braiding, non-trivial statistics. It's very basic, and therefore I think it's very nice. It's in one form, it's spin or charge fractalization, but particles may actually carry no spin and no charge. In that case, anions carry completely new quantum numbers. For instance, the Z2 charge and the Z2 vorticity, Z2 flux, are the new quantum numbers for the toric-coated anions, and they are conserved modulo 2. So new conservation laws emerge basically out of nothing, out of interactions between the underlying spins. And this is most important. There are some subtler properties like local conservation laws, or in other words, fusion rules, and finally braiding. However, if we want to detect anions, it's probably best to focus on the basic properties. And if we know that anions can only be created in pairs because of the conservation rule, this can be used to infer the following thing. If we study absorption, say, of photons or Newton's scattering, and we do a momentum and energy result experiment, if particles are created in pairs, then there is no singularity in the energy momentum space, whereas for the creation of single particles, there is a singularity at epsilon of p, the dispersion curve. And another way, at least speculative, to detect an anion is to create a local trap, a weak spot where the couplings between the spins are small, are weaker than in the surrounding area. And this spot will hold an anion, and the anion will have properties like polarizability or other local physical properties different from the surrounding area. And such anions do not decay. That is the most important feature that can be tested in an experiment. Yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Okay, I think we've got time for a quick question. There is one.
You mentioned the equivalence between the diamond model in Kagome lattice and and the toric coat, right? Is it only are they only equivalent when the three diamond resonant moves, or they are equivalent for much more general diamond models?
No, they're equivalent for a certain Hamiltonian. Actually, I don't remember the exact form of that Hamiltonian.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, well, maybe...